Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
So you go in the bureau and you guys have different squads. They were responsible for different crimes, right?
Right.
And what was your preference? What were you hoping to get when you got to the DC office?
Oh, the cool stuff. I wanted to work gangs and drugs and homicides and, you know, organized crime, you know, the stuff that the reason why people join the FBI, that I wanted to kick in doors and wrestle with bad guys on the streets, just at the federal level, you know, a little more class. I don't know. I mean, I wanted to do the cool stuff. I had two criminal justice degrees. I had been in the Army, but the infantry, it's not like I was in military intelligence. I had been a cop, and I thought the FBI would look at my resume and say, well, he's going to go work drugs or gangs. And like, no, that's not what they said. They said, you're going to work Cuban counterintelligence. And I was floored, frankly. I had no idea what the hell that was. What do you mean Cuban? You know, again, this is pre-9/11, so we had one day of national security training. That included counterterrorism, counterintelligence, counterespionage. It probably included a little bit of cyber, whatever that looked like in 1998. So they, you know, this is a cram one day. This is what you're going to need to know about national security cases. So counterintelligence was maybe a 1 hour presentation of that one day.
Wow. That sounds like just one of the classes. Let's just get through this and go to lunch.
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Maybe I have to work this. Hopefully I don't, because I'm going to go work bank robberies and, you know, cool stuff, because I was a cop. I mean, of course, the FBI is so brilliant. That's what they'll do, is maybe help me have me doing the cool stuff. And they had other plans for me.
They always do, it seems like.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you're heading to the Washington, D.C. office. And when did you know that they were going to assign you to counterintelligence on Cuba before you walked in the door or after you got in the door?
Yes. I got a call at Quantico from my new boss. And she was calling to not so gently break the news and introduce herself. And then she called, you know, we had phones in our rooms. And I don't know why. Was I there and picked up the phone, or did I call her back? I can't remember. And she said, hey, you know, my name is Diane. I want to introduce myself. I'm your new supervisor. You're coming to work Cuban counterintelligence. And I said, what the hell is that? And she said, well, I can't tell you over the phone. I'm like, what? What do you mean you can't tell me what we do over the phone? Like, this is just like, I'm being punked, right? You know, this does not sound like the cool stuff. I can't talk on the phone. Like, this is not how I was brought up, and how I, you know, my dreams are dying here as we speak, you know, on this call. And, you know, I was angry for moodier, I guess is maybe a better way of saying it, for a couple of days, maybe a couple of weeks. I graduated in September of 1998. And I remember distinctly, my wife and I at the time were in our apartment. We were doing some temporary housing, and on TV was arrests. The FBI had made a big arrest in Miami of 10 Cuban illegal officers. It was the Loretta Vispa case. The media called it the Cuban Five, the Miami Five. And I was like, oh, well, that's kind of cool. Like, maybe I'll get to do some of that, you know, that's on CNN now. And so that kind of got me a little, all right, maybe there's something to this Cuban counterintelligence thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we started doing some, I got on the squad and started meeting some of my coworkers. Some were older and a lot of them were my age and just coming in. And we started doing some really cool things and some real interesting work. And then it kind of sunk in that, you know, you're doing things that are pushing back at Fidel Castro. And I mean, how many people in history that are known by only their first name? You know, Tiger. True. You know, right?
Pablo.
Pablo. You know, you know, Adolf, obviously, but like even Reagan, Ronald, if you say Ronald, people are going to like McDonald, right? You know, I mean, like there are certain people that they you're known by your first, and you say the name Fidel and you know exactly who you're talking about. So that international kind of intrigue really started to seep into me. And it was kind of cool because we would meet sources in Starbucks. And coffee shops and at nice restaurants. And it was like, oh, I can get used to this. You know, we're not behind a seedy motel at 3 o'clock in the morning. We're a lot more civilized than, and I started not to be a narcissist, but it was like, I could deal with this kind of schedule. This is like good living, shall we say.
There's no rule that says we got to go hang out in these damn dives that we do. It just seems to be what happens.
Yeah, exactly. No, we were civilized, shall we say.
It's funny you mentioned that because the first case that I'm the new guy. I've been a cop for 12 years when I get to DEA Miami. But the first case I work on, the senior partner, Gene Fracar, has been working this for a couple of years. And we go to meet two of his informants. And this is the first time I'm going out to meet any informants as a DEA agent. And I'm thinking, man, this is going to be cool. We're going to get in his Lamborghini and we're going to go down the Continental down Miami Bay. And, you know, and it's just going to be just like you see on TV.
Yeah, your soundtrack.
We're getting this. We're getting this old ratted out Chrysler LeBaron that he had to move his clothes out of the front seat so I'd have a place to sit. We go to the Denny's on 36th Street across from Miami Airport, dingy as it could be. And I'm thinking, well, okay, these two informants are going to come in. They're going to be high speed, low drag. These two old men come in, one white guy and one Asian man. I'm thinking, and I should have known this. Their nicknames were Cheech and Chong. That was my introduction to DEA. But you know who the case was focusing on?
Who's that?
It's Fidel and Raul Castro.
Oh,
the
wow.
Castro brothers. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because they were allowing the country to be used as a transshipment point for cocaine. Yep. So I like that crossover there. Not that I have any kind of the dealings that you do, but it's very eye-opening, isn't it? Because when you've been a small-town cop and all of a sudden you're looking at these world leaders and you're thinking, man, this is what I wanted to do.
Yep. I just didn't know it. Like, you know, fortuitous that the FBI said, no, you're going to go do this. And like, how cool is that? I mean, you'd have to actually read the front page of the Washington Post and or the New York Times or the Washington Times, whatever. We got both and read about what's going on in the world and have that world understanding versus what's going on in Coatesville, what's going on in Philadelphia. You know, your world, your aperture just opened up incredibly and in a good way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And just, you know, and at that point, there's no looking back. It's like, this is what I wanted to do. I'm good.
Yep.
So your office, are you in the, I'm pretty sure you're not, but just for our listeners, are you in the J. Edgar Hoover building or you're in an offsite?
No, the Washington field office is about 4 blocks from FBI headquarters. And the field office is the field office for the Washington, D.C. area, whereas FBI headquarters oversees the entire country. And there's supposed to be a separation between the headquarters and the field office. The nuance is that FBI likes to think that Washington Field is like a satellite office of it. They like to micromanage the field office stuff. And there's a lot of managers who kind of go back and forth because they don't have to move their families, which is, you know, it's a lot. So, we were about 4 blocks away. And, you know, we would go and shoot sometimes. Or back then, they had the pre-9/11, they would do the tour. And a lot of the Washington field agents would go and give the tour, the shooting part of the tour, and give a shooting demonstration to the people that would come in. But that all changed after 9/11.
Yeah, a lot of things changed after that, didn't it?
Yep.
So you're in the office now. Did you guys have take-home G cars?
We did. Nice. I had Pimp Daddy. Pimp Daddy was the nickname. It was a Buick LeSabre. It had at one time had been the take-home car for the assistant director in charge, the top dog in the office. And then every year, I'm sure he would get a new car. And this got filtered down along with the shock absorbers. And the shock stopped working and it would bounce. So you'd kind of push on the trunk and it would bounce up and down. It had tinted windows in velour seats. And I thought it was like the coolest thing because it, and it was like a maroon color. So it looked like what a pimp would drive. Like it really was totally in character. But I guess I get it in 1998. I guess in 1991, that was a fresh car for the ADIC, for the guy in charge of the office. But yeah, I was very proud of that car. I do miss that car. For the entertainment value alone was just, it was awesome.
Oh, I can't imagine the ribbon you got from the guys in the squad, because here comes Pete and his big hoopty down the street.
Yep. Where's the crown? You got a little crown, gold crown on the dashboard, you know.
Hey, Pete, if you come over to my house, don't bring that car.
I'm sure it's been salvaged by this point in time.
We had a guy in our group in Miami, I'll just say his first name, Drew, that inherited this big, big-ass Cadillac. I mean, it was the biggest Cadillac you could get. And his neighbors, after a couple months of parking that thing in his driveway, they came and asked him not to bring it back in the neighborhood. Oh, crazy stuff.
That's funny.
So, all right. So you're in the office now.
Yeah.
How do you get involved in this investigation on this lady who is suspected of potentially being a spy for Cuba?
So we had the day in and day out work of counterintelligence. And then the Cuba program had these, we call them legacy cases. And they had been handed down over the years. The reality was we should have been prioritizing this in reverse order. Priority should have been the legacy cases, and then the secondary should have been what we were doing day in and day out, because the legacy cases were far more important, frankly. But we had a significant amount of what we called unsub cases, unknown subjects. And we knew that the Cubans had penetrated the U.S. very broadly, not specifically what agencies or departments, but we knew a lot of tidbits, as I talk about and write about in the book. So I became sensitized to these cases. I started working, you know, we started being a part of meetings with the National Security Agency, which I can now say because it's gone through pre-publication review. And they, you know, very secretive agency, but a lot of really, really smart people were talking about the communication MO and how the Cubans would communicate to this agent versus that agent versus this illegal officer. They would use Morse code versus voice and just a whole lot of information. And then it was the Christmas party, the squad Christmas party of 2000. And my partner, my venture partner, Steve McCoy, who was about 25 years older than I am, and maybe 20. And he had one of the unsub cases, and we're talking and just kind of shooting the breeze. And he said, yeah, we got a name with this one. And, you know, my dad, going back to that theme of my father, right?
Mm-hmm.
My dad at the age of 10 made my sister and I get a Morse code license. Because, of course, you know, what 10-year-old would rather learn Morse code than learn how to play third base and, you know, bunt, right? So Heather and I, my sister, would be in the basement listening to tapes of da 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 da. It's just like, you know, it's like we're going to be in a submarine somewhere as a communicator, right?
Yeah.
We get this ham radio license, and it's he made me do it. And but with the high frequency messages that the Cubans would send to Anna, I saw this as a hook. And I said to Steve, I said, you know, I have a ham radio license. I don't really tell a lot of people that, but
doesn't come up in conversation.
It doesn't naturally come. No, but not only do I know Morse code, which was BS, I'd long forgotten Morse code, but I know the theory, the high frequency theory part of it all. So I could be a really valuable asset to you. And the reality was that I didn't need to really sell him too much. He needed a partner, and out of everyone on the squad, he and I, he thought he and I would mesh best together. And to this day, I'm incredibly appreciative of Steve asking me to be his partner, because I keep saying this, but the course of my life changed in that moment. And, you know, we became partners from that day until she was off to incarceration in Texas.
Now, how much time does Steve have on the job at this point? He's not fresh out of the academy. He's a seasoned veteran.
No. He probably had, I'm going to say he probably had 20, almost 25 years in. He had come into the FBI not as a police officer, but his father had been an agent.
Mm-hmm.
But he will tell you, my father had nothing to do with me becoming an agent. Steve came in, he had a law degree. He graduated from Duke University, a very prestigious school, obviously, with an English literature degree. And then he went to the George Mason Law School. So he was a lawyer, and he was working at FBI headquarters as a clerk, you know, a starter job, but working in the FOIA office, the Freedom of Information Act office. Ugh. And got his way into the FBI that way, and then became an agent. And his father had nothing to do with it. And he's very proud of that. But by that point in time, he had about 25 years in the FBI. I want to say he did something with the Hinckley case. He sees some evidence, or he was a part of that investigation. It was huge, no doubt, but he worked that to a very little bit, and would often talk about that.
Was his career primarily in counterintelligence?
Most of it, yeah. He did do a little street work, working drugs, I want to say in Ohio. I think maybe his first office was Youngstown, Ohio. And then he went to WFO, Washington Field Office. And then, but he had been working Cuba for about 15 years by that point in time. So he was a very much counterintelligence agent, Cuba guy. Mm-hmm. Someone that had worked the majority of his career on Cuban counterintelligence. So definitely this wise, sage kind of avuncular character on the squad.
What a great person to be teamed up with, especially if your personalities get along and he's not treating you like the bastard child.
No.
You know, be his gopher.
Yeah, no, not at all. He always treated me as a peer, and very easily could have treated me as the junior case agent. Mm-hmm. Like, we were co-case agents. We were legit, straight-up partners, but he was senior and I was junior. I mean, that's the fact, but never treated me like that. Even though he was a lawyer, you know, my niche, I think, was finding, you know, where do we need the elements of the crime? Here's mm-hmm. espionage. What evidence do we need for that? Kind of thinking as a cop. And how do we get there thinking as a cop? And Steve had kind of been working in counterintelligence for so long, I think his mind started to think differently. He was starting to think about, what would Fidel do? And what does the Cuban intelligence do? He became an expert on Cuban intelligence, but maybe I thought what I brought to the table was like the practicality. How do we prove this versus that? And what's important? I don't care what Fidel had for breakfast. Important probably in what he normally eats, but like, where does he get the food from? You know, that's the kind of thing that I think we were very compatible in that way.
Well, plus, to charge anybody, there are certain elements with every crime that have to be met before you can get that indictment. Yep. So you do need somebody that has that perspective and that focus to make sure you are meeting those elements.
Yep. Yep.
Now, I'm guessing you knew very little about counterintel at the time. How or were you surprised when you found out that the target was a female?
You know, her gender at the time didn't jump out at me as being unusual. I started focusing, like, I pulled the Robert Hansen arrest warrant. I pulled the Aldrich Ames arrest warrant. I got him off the internet, and I started to see, like, Hansen's was like 112 pages. It's like, wow.
Jeez.
So I started to think about, okay, this is what we needed to prove espionage in these cases. So started getting in that mindset of, that's kind of what we're going to need for her. But it didn't really strike me until after she was arrested and probably a couple of years down the road, where it was, when you go back and start to study espionage and study the history, you start to look at the cases, it's like, there's not a lot of women here. Like, what's the deal? So that definitely finally jumped out at me, but not in that moment. I don't remember that being, wow, she's a woman. Like, this is so weird and rare. That fact didn't strike me until years later.
You know, I didn't know this till I read your book, but what I learned is typically if there were female spies, that they were partners with a husband or a significant male other.
Yep.
That, you know, I guess like Steve, your partner, would have picked up on that strange fact that, wow, it looks like she's working solely. You know, she's not partnered up with anybody. Now, tell us a little bit about her background, where she's from and her family, if you would.
So she was born in Germany on a military base because her father was in the army at the time. Oldest of four, two boys and two girls. Mom and dad, it's a proud Puerto Rican family. The siblings tell me that the parents raised them very morally. You know, they had political differences, but from a moral, raised very morally. Dad definitely was, you would probably his parenting style, as I like to say, in 2024 would have received phone calls from CPS and child services. Yeah, he was pretty physical with all of the children and their mother and then his next family. But I don't believe that played a major role in what happened with her. Anna's the oldest. Lucy and Tito, her brother and her sister, become FBI employees themselves. Her brother Tito became an agent in the spring of 1988. And then Lucy became a translator for the FBI in Miami, actually. She was working translations down in Miami. And both of them served honorably and retired honorably from the FBI and were proud FBI employees. And what Anna did runs completely antithetical to how the family was raised and the values that all of the Montez family has.
So are all four children, are they college graduates?
I believe at least three of the four. The youngest, the baby of the family, went into, he didn't work in the government. He worked for companies. I believe he went to college. I actually don't know much about him, to be honest with you. He's kind of flown under the radar. He didn't work for the government, so like no one really. He enjoys that too, by the way. I've never met him. I've never talked to him. He's a wonderful guy. I heard nothing but great things about him, but he's kind of flying under the radar because no one really knows about him.
I was wondering because there was just a very high level mention of him, but nothing further. And when you look at, you know, the dad was in the U.S. military and the son or brother is a FBI agent. The other is a linguist for the FBI. Anna herself now, and typically when we're here on Game of Crimes, we don't mention these pieces of shit that we're talking about. But in this particular case, we are, because I think there's not enough notoriety that goes along with anybody that's willing to be a traitor against their own country, a country that's taken care of them, that especially when they grew up, like you said, with a very patriotic background that, you know, We're glad to be here in the United States and we want to take advantage of everything it has to offer, but we also want to pay back.
Yeah.
And you just got to respect people like that. But not certainly not Anna. Apparently she was very intelligent because where'd she go to college?
University of Virginia. Got her undergraduate from UVA, which is a outstanding institution, and then got a master's degree from a very prestigious graduate program in DC called it's Johns Hopkins, but School of Advanced International Studies. I mean, she is and continues to be an incredibly intelligent person.
Mm-hmm. And I was just quickly looking up the acceptance rate at UVA right now. Of course, she was there years and years and years ago, but right now it's only about 18% of those that apply get accepted. So it is, it's really should be considered an Ivy League school, in my opinion. I think that highly of UVA.
Yeah, and I'm kind of proud. I wrote this in the book, but I don't think I highlighted it enough. So Anna always, I think intellectually she looked down on me because I was this dumb street cop who couldn't tell the difference between a Contra and a Sandinista. And I frankly didn't care. So and it's not just me that she has an intellectual arrogance against. It's pretty much anyone that she comes in contact with. So she goes to UVA, and here's this dumb cop is a part of somebody who arrested her. My daughter got into University of Virginia and turned him down.
Good for her.
Very proud. I am proud to say she declined her entrance into University of Virginia and now is at the, well, I don't want to say, but she's at a really, really, really good school. Has a phenomenal football program, and she's a straight up smarty. I don't know who her father is, but he's a smart man. He is. So I'm just very proud to. I know she won't listen to this, but Anna, if you're listening, my daughter rejected UVA.
There you go. That's a little shot.
Boom.
No problem. She should be honored we're even mentioning her name on this show because we usually don't. You know. And I'll get into my personal opinion here towards the end, but tell us more about her personality, because it was it would just rub you raw, wouldn't it?
It did, yeah. For 7 months, it did. She didn't interact very well interpersonally in the different environments. I mean, her own family has described her as odd and not easy to get along with, and this is blood, right? Mm-hmm. Coworkers didn't often like to work with her. It was not an enjoyable experience. Anna never really suffered fools lightly. And to her, you know, everyone was a fool, especially when, you know, you're not to her intellectual character or level, and you're also believing in what we stand for here in the United States. You're working for the Department of Defense or the U.S. intelligence community, and you're loyal to it. So you're even more stupid in Anna's eyes than you know, she normally would treat people. So she wasn't real fun to interact with, but you know, incredibly smart and a go-to person. People reached out to her and, you know, did respect her analytic judgment and her knowledge when it came to Cuba and the different topics that she was working on. It's just, they didn't know that she was really smart on Cuba and actually smarter than most people because she really knew the Cubans, like, mm-hmm. really, really well.
So I mentioned at the very beginning of this about our topic today being having a very narcissistic personality with an ego that's just out of control. And all I know about her is what I read in your book. It comes across loud and clear that she thought she was smarter than everybody else. And it seemed like she had an extremely strong work ethic to do what she was doing.
Yeah. So it wasn't just me, you know, I don't have a psychology background, so it's not Pete saying she's a narcissist. It's the PhDs that tested her and evaluated her during the debriefings. They actually diagnosed her with narcissism. Well, not that I couldn't kind of already see that, but she thought incredibly, she did work very hard, but for different reasons. You know, she worked hard because it would open more doors for her. And the more doors that opened up, the more intelligence that she would become exposed to help the nighttime job of helping the Cubans. So she did not enjoy working at DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, but if she was going to be there, her attitude was, well, let me do the best job I can because who knows what kind of things I can get open to and involved in that the Cubans will want to know about.
So she did have some forward-thinking capabilities, which, I mean, you and I both know how many guys we've worked with that don't have that. It's so much better when they do.
And she actually, a lot of people, her management actually encouraged her to apply for management positions. Like they mm-hmm. thought, like, you're that good, you should be a manager. And she's like, no, I don't like the people stuff. And, you know, I want to work the cases. I want to work the issues. And the reality was maybe that should have been a little bit of a clue. Not that, you know, there were people that were born to be managers and people that should not be managers. And, mm-hmm. You know, people that didn't want to go into management because they just knew that wasn't, you have to deal with people things and performances and you kind of get away from the casework, the street work, if you will. And she wanted to stay working as an analyst, not wanting to deal with the management type issues, but it was for double reasons, obviously.
So considering her background, what was her interest in Cuba and what do you think her motivation was for spying against her own home country to support Fidel Castro?
Being Puerto Rican, I think that her area of study always, it was in international affairs. So it always kind of would drift towards Latin America because of her ethnicity. I don't think she did not have the same kind of interest in the Far East or Europe and Russia. I think that she was more anti-American. Her attitude was, how dare the United States dictate how another country should run itself? How dare the U.S. say that Puerto Rico should be a commonwealth of the United States versus an independent country? How dare it say that, you know, the Castro regime is bad for the Cuban people? And Anna would always see the flaws in our country and focus on them. So I wouldn't say that she's pro-Cuba. Their just hatred of the United States really aligns and matched up really well. Whereas, like, if China had found her and spotted her and pitched her, or if the Soviet Union did, I don't think it would have had the same kind of results that Cuba did because of Latin America.
I know you kind of hinted at it in your book as to what led to these feelings, but it doesn't seem there's any, like there's any really conclusive, you know, point your finger at that and put it right on top of that. That's why she decided to be a traitor. Is that fair to say? Did I miss something?
Reagan's policy in El Salvador and Nicaragua, you know, back to Iran-Contra, mm-hmm. we were supporting the Contras and sending the CIA and special operation folks to a sovereign country, you know, fighting guerrilla wars, trying to overthrow democratically elected governments, communism, you know, air quotes around democratically elected, kind of like Russia mm-hmm. recently. You know, that kind of Reagan and his policies, more his policies versus him and his politics, I think was the catalyst, her call to action. She was already disgruntled at what the U.S. was doing in Latin America. And therefore, when she met someone who introduced her to the Cubans, the moons aligned and she was, her heart and mind were in the right place at the right time. But I think that transition, because Reagan, he's president until 1988, obviously, and then George H.W. Bush comes into office. And we were no longer in El Salvador and Nicaragua.
Mm-hmm.
But when Bill Clinton came into office in 1992, he kept the same policy with regards to Cuba. The policy didn't change. And I argue Anna did as much damage during the Clinton administration than she did during the Reagan-Bush administrations, perhaps even more. So it's not a political conversation. It's a policy conversation. But I do think Reagan's policy was the catalyst. If Reagan didn't have this policy in El Salvador, Nicaragua, would she have been that call to action? I don't think so. I don't think just the Cuban embargo would have been enough for her to say, I can help. I think it had to be this illegal war in her mind in Nicaragua.
So how can you tell us a little bit more about it? How did the Cubans find out that Ana Montes might be a sympathizer towards their country?
In graduate school, you know, she was a student at CICE and, you know, talking openly in an academic environment, as, you know, we should encourage everyone to do, and really was overheard by an American woman who was also Puerto Rican. So they had a lot in common.
Mm-hmm.
And Marta Velasquez is her name, and she befriends Ana. There are actually family photos from the Montes family of Marta at events, family events. And they were very close. And Marta said, you know, do you want to help Nicaragua? And she said, absolutely. And then she said, I have a friend who wants to meet you. He's a Cuban. Ana said, is he a diplomat or is he just a citizen? Like, no, he's a diplomat. And they took the train up to New York City to have dinner with a diplomat, a Cuban diplomat. Ana was at the Department of Justice at the time. She was working at Maine Justice as a clerk, kind of like Steve McCoy was mm-hmm. working at the FBI, different times, and was working in the FOIA office, ironically. This was just a day job, just the, you know, first job out of college kind of thing, paying the bills, not the life ambition. But she knew better than to have dinner, a private dinner with a Cuban diplomat. That's she had enough training, security training to know that's bad, but had no reservations in having dinner with him.
See, for me, that would just raise the flag right there that why the heck would I would fly up to New York, take the train or whatever? Why would I go to New York City to meet somebody I don't know? I mean, if it's going for a potential date or, you know, I don't know, something like that might be enticing, but just to go meet somebody, just to me, that just raises 1,000 red flags.
Yeah, it should, but I think her mind's in the right place. Her mind's not in the right place. Her mind's in that place where, you know, U.S.
She's
bad.
She's susceptible to that.
U.S. bad. You know, anyone else is better than the United States, so I'll meet with a Cuban, sure, because the United States is bad.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Lowe's knows that more projects mean more tools. For a limited time, new and existing MyLowe's Rewards credit card members can get 12-month special financing on purchases of $299 or more, in-store and online. Don't wait to get the things you need. Get special financing today. Lowe's. We help. You save. Now through August 27th, choose 12-month special financing on purchases of $299 or more. Offer subject to credit approval and cannot be combined. Minimum monthly payments required. See store or Lowe's.com for details.
Yeah, you know, I would highly encourage people that have that sentiment to, you know, pack your bag and go live somewhere else. You know, if I was king for a day, I think I would require Americans to go live in a foreign country for a year and then come back and tell me a third world country, not the UK, not a nice place. Go see what it's like there. Hell, go to Cuba and then come back and tell me what you think.
Yeah, it's interesting because Anna told Lucy one time, her sister, that the Cubans have all they need. You know, which is like, okay, that's interesting. So now that you're free, where do you choose to live, Anna? Because you do have a choice. You can live in Cuba if you want. It's a one-way trip. They will welcome you, and the United States isn't going to like keep the door shut so you don't leave. We'll gladly open the door for you and let you depart if you want. But when you have this choice, you'd rather live in Puerto Rico. In the United States, the country that you hate, and not live in Cuba. And I thought that was like really, and there's a family reason for that. Her mother's still alive and she wants to spend time with her mother. I respect that. But at the same time, it's like, it's just kind of hypocritical.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's one of the things that makes my blood boil. I'm really working on my language here.
I give you credit because
I loved everything about your book. And I will mention this at the end also, but it's one of those books that you get and you can't put it down.
Thank you.
You just want to keep going. And I occasionally wake up in the middle of the night and can't go back to sleep. And then I'll sit up and read. And, you know, the bad thing about your book was where I'd usually sit up and read maybe 30 minutes. I might've been up for 90 minutes, you know. It's that kind of book, everybody.
That's far better than my book, Putting You to Sleep. That's really, you know, that would be like, oh, well, I had a hard time sleeping, so I started reading your book, and it worked.
Well, you,
thank you.
You may not know this, but my old DEA partner, Javier Pena, I wrote a book, and it's called Manhunters. Damn, I couldn't even remember the name of my own book. Thankfully, I got it right here next to me. But we market that book as a sure cure for insomnia. So now Anna's doing her little thing, but she's not being a spy in the traditional sense. Like when I was going to be stationed overseas with DEA, they sent us to the Knife and Fork School with State Department, and we have CIA come in and work with us for a few days, and they teach you brush passes and drop, you know, how to drop things in secret places and, you know, little spy techniques, how to counter surveillance and just be aware and all that kind of stuff. But she didn't want to participate in any of that, did she?
Yeah, no. And it's interesting because you would think that the fun part of committing espionage is all of that. Mm-hmm. The radio, the computer, the brush passes, the dead, you know, all that. That's kind of the James Bond part of it. And she did not get any enjoyment out of that part. You know, it was counterintuitive to her. Yeah, the radio stuff, she'd have to pull out the directions every single time to encrypt and decrypt, you know, needed the step-by-step. So, but didn't seem to really enjoy the act of committing espionage, which I think would be like, that's kind of a fun part, right? You know, the sneaking around and, you know, this and that and the other thing. But
yeah,
no, not for her.
She was more prone to face-to-face meetings with her handler, wasn't she? Which to me is just inviting trouble.
Mind-blowing. And, you know, from a security perspective, mind-blowing. And but this is where Kelly Kennedy, and by all means, bring this up with her, because when you interview her, because she really helped me. First of all, there's no one else I would have wanted to write this book than with Kelly. She's phenomenal and just, you know, really helped me, frankly, get into the mind of a woman. Mm-hmm. And in a great way, because she said, I think you need to look at these meetings differently. You know, don't look at from the operational security, I'm going to get caught perspective. Look at it from the emotional intimacy perspective.
Right.
Anna really had to, there's no one else in the United States who knew the real her than the guy sitting across the table from her, who was her Cuban illegal officer. That's what we would call them. And she called her friend. And that guy knew everything about her. her hopes, her dreams, her secret missions, where she lived. I mean, he knew more about her than her mother. And therefore, this personal meeting that for us was mind-blowing and like, oh my God, you could have got caught. For her, it helped her sustain her for 17 years. It was that emotional connection that she needed to keep going because she wasn't getting that from another intimate relationship or an intimate relationship that she would have because she couldn't do both worlds. She couldn't have a long-term boyfriend and a shortwave radio with a laptop. The two are not going to work. So these relationships, these friends of hers, Kelly helped me look at it from a vastly different perspective. And now it makes a lot more sense.
It does to me also, as you're saying that, because I had not thought of it like that. But, you know, here's somebody who, like you say, she has no personal relationship with a male. Right. This could be right. her surrogate relationship.
Yeah.
Just because it, and she may have been thinking that, hey, it's just the appearance is going to be, here's a young lady and a young man sitting down having dinner together. They might be on a date.
Yeah. Yeah. Two Hispanic people having dinner at lunch in D.C. Like it happens hundreds and hundreds of times a weekend.
Absolutely.
So what's the big deal? In reality, hiding in plain sight and committing espionage in plain sight.
Can you explain to us, what information was she collecting and how was she getting that to the Cubans? Because I think this is phenomenal. I hate giving anybody of her stature credit for anything, but this is kind of phenomenal to hear.
She had top secret information because she had a top secret clearance. In addition, she had what we call SCI, secret special compartmented information, secret compartment.
Sensitive.
Thank you. And, you know, so would get tickets, would get read into different compartments of even more sensitive information. The most sensitive information that she had access to that did not have to do with a human being was a program called BYEMAN, B-Y-E-M-A-N. And it belonged to the National Reconnaissance Office, which is our satellite, the agency of the intelligence community that handles satellites. People can Google it and look on Wikipedia. They actually, now the National Reconnaissance Office will tweet, I think we still call it tweet, on X, when they're launching a rocket that has assuming spy satellites on it. You can follow it on Twitter. But back when Anna was doing it, the program itself, the word BYEMAN was classified secret. You couldn't even say the word BYEMAN in public. And without, if you had a clearance without potentially getting into a security problem. So probably a couple billion dollar program that she gave to Fidel with little reservation. She had a little bit of hesitation because she knew how damaging it was to the US government. Mm-hmm. But in the end of the day, she said, if it's important to them, in the United States, it's important for the Cubans to know.
So how did she get that information? Is this what, I know what the answer is, but did she pass it to her handler or was there another means that she used?
No, at lunch, these lunch meetings, you know, would put them on a floppy disk, would encrypt them and then slide them across the table, you know, as they ordered. And, you know, he would discreetly pick it up and put it in his pocket. And then they would actually have conversations about what she was telling the Cubans on the disk. In public, you know, but using cryptic names. They wouldn't say the CIA is thinking about doing this or the White House is. Mm-hmm. They would have cute names for different agencies. So they could talk publicly, so to speak. I'm sure it was an odd conversation that people were overhearing it. A lot of barnyard animals and, you know, birds and, you know, the pelican is talking to the ostrich.
Yeah, we could take that in a lot of different directions, but we won't.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, you mentioned the shortwave radio. What was that for?
So the Cubans would transmit high-frequency messages to the United States in different bands that you could hear from New England to North Carolina. And then she would take out her shortwave radio that are commercially available, nothing special, nothing illegal. Hobbyists, you know, all around the world have shortwave radios and would listen to the broadcast at a specific day, time, and frequency. And then she could tell which one was a real message and what was a camouflaged message. So that was the chew from the Cubans to Anna. You know, hey, following up on this information you gave, can you give us more some of the mechanics of what she was reporting and clarifying some things from time to time. And then also like, hey, you know, you're not going to meet this week. You're going to meet next week.
Did she have one of the infamous, James Bond miniature cameras or? How did she How did she get that information? I mean, I know how she got it. It was through her job, but how did she get that to the shortwave radio?
Well, mostly she would type them up on a computer. Reports, you know, her classified information that she would report, she would memorize these tidbits of top secret information. Come home and after memorizing them, would type them up on a computer and then encrypt them using the Cuban-created encryption software, put it on a floppy disk, and then would wait until the lunch meeting and provide it that way. But memorized and then wrote it up. It was almost like a dear diary. Like, today I was read in on this program, mm-hmm. and this is what the program does. Kind of a narrative, wow. really. Just a journal, really.
And the fact that she's memorizing classified information, I don't, like you said in your book, I don't think that the U.S. has created a software program that can read a mind yet.
No, thank God. Thank God, no. No, no. I do not recommend any vendor out there listening to do that.
You
might make billions of dollars, but the society will cease to exist if we can start reading minds.
So I don't want to get into more specific details because I want people to read your book. It is worthy of the read. I'm pretty sure that once you pick it up, you're not going to be able to set it down. But you guys finally get to the point where you've got enough to arrest Anna. You do arrest her. I don't want to give up any of those details either. That's pretty cool to read about. But now, what does she do? Does she hire a lawyer and fight you guys? Or what sentences is she looking at here for her treacherous activities? What penalties?
The most, if we went to trial, based on the evidence that we could present, which was not all the evidence that we had, but the evidence that we were allowed to present, mm-hmm. the most she was looking at was a life sentence. So, which is a lot, don't get me wrong. She hired an attorney named Plato Cacheras, who was also Robert Hansen's attorney. He was Audrey mm-hmm. Ames's attorney. Ironically, he was Monica Lewinsky's attorney. He got her the immunity deal. Phenomenal attorney. Just a great guy. A ton of admiration I have and respect for him. He's a really good guy and a really good attorney. Does a good job representing his clients. Don't get me wrong. He's not like on the prosecution side, but mm-hmm. fair and looks out for his client's best interest. And he knew that I go to trial, I'm gonna lose, and it's gonna be a life sentence. So we're starting negotiating in terms of time from life. And what is someone who is 46 years old looking at from a life expectancy? You know, I'm sure that's the equation that he was looking at. Well, if she lives to 95 years old, then a 40-year sentence is a life sentence. So how do we get her something so that she, in exchange for this full debriefing that the government's going to require her to give, in exchange for a plea? Because if we're going to give you time off, we want to know who, what, when, where, why, and how you did what you did. So we came up with 25. No magic formula to it. You do tend to look at other cases and other precedents, but I came up with the number 25, frankly, because I needed to get out of the FBI before Anna got out of prison.
I love it.
I'm making a comparison between the FBI and prison. Yes, I am. but no, seriously, it was important for me to get out of the FBI. Steve could retire at any point in time, so he didn't care from that perspective, but we settled on a 25-year plea agreement. And at the time, I thought it was huge. And like 25 years will never come. Like it'll be just so far down the road. It's like she's going to be in jail for an incredibly long time. And now we're, what are we, like 18 months after she's released. And it's like, man, I wish 25 was 30 or 30 was 35, you know.
January 6, 2023, she was released.
Yeah.
I got to say, I was shocked to read that. I grew up a redneck hillbilly. I say I bleed blue, but I really bleed red, white, and blue. Plea bargaining with these kind of people is, I know it's part of what we do, but sometimes it's just hard to take. But because of that plea bargain, like you said, she's got to give up the goods. She's got to sit down with you guys.
Yep.
And how long did that take?
7 months. Seven long months.
When I read that, I'm thinking I would have had to turn my gun in because I'd have probably shot myself after about three or four sitting down with a condescending witch like that.
Steve did a much better job. In writing the book and talking about the book and a little maturity, a lot of maturity, frankly, I think I could have worn less of my emotions on my sleeve. And Steve was very good at building that rapport with her. We were both very good at treating her very professionally. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, she'd come in the room shackled, and I would unhandcuff her, and she had roam of the room, the 20 by 20 foot room, and could get water and fruit. And we treated her incredibly professionally.
Better than she deserved.
Well, you know, yeah. I mean, better than she treated Greg Fronius when she probably gave up his identity and he was later killed.
Mm-hmm. You have to read the book, everybody, to find out about this story.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, you know, that's what the FBI does. We treat people professionally when we interview them. And it's important. I think it's important. It shows we treat them better than they would treat us.
Right.
And I think that's, we should be doing that, I think. But it wasn't easy for me. And it wasn't, you know, just to give some context, this is not even a year after 9/11. So for me, you know, we're still finding, you know, people at Ground Zero and in the Pentagon, and we're interacting with someone that had no problem doing what she did and really had no, was not emotionally moved by 9/11 in any way, shape, mm-hmm. or form. So that was just really, really difficult to deal with.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she just herself described it as torture. She said, this is torture for me. And actually Steve and I were mutually offended. It's like, is your salad not good enough? I'm sorry. You know, she goes, no, you guys are treating me really well. I'm sorry. It's just, I wish I didn't take the plea and didn't have to betray my friends. Well, so, sorry, you did. What was his name? What was his name? You know, and tell me, give me his description and tell me all about him.
Because if she hadn't, what would have happened?
I mean, she was then looking at a life sentence. You know, if she walked in the room and kept her mouth shut and didn't answer a question, then she'd go to, the plea was out, and she'd go to trial and spend the rest of her life in prison. So
yeah,
she took the plea primarily because of her mother and wanting to see her mom before her mother passed and spend some time with her, and she's been able to do that.
So, and you know what? I'm going to stop the I feel like I'm questioning you here. And I just want to say that the reason you want these people to give up the ghost is we learn from it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the more information we have, you know, power is knowledge. Knowledge is power, especially in these type of investigations where all these foreign countries are trying to infiltrate our country for very nefarious reasons. And Anne is a perfect example of that. But you want to find out more details, you got to get the book. Again, it is Queen of Cuba, Queen of Cuba, an FBI agent's insider account of the spy who evaded detection for 17 years. It will be listed on our book page on the Game of Crimes podcast website with a link there. You can go to Amazon now and get it. That's where I got my copy. But I want to ask you, now that you're retired from the Bureau, tell us what you're doing now.
So I went to work for a company and worked there for about 18 months and just didn't like industry. I went out and started my own consulting in insider threat and decided to write the book at the same time. Took about 2 years to get the book done and through the pre-publication review. Mm-hmm. You know, the book's done decent. I think it's going to do a little better after next Sunday. This coming Sunday, May 19th, I will tell you and your audience, I know they'll hear this afterwards, but they can go to YouTube and watch 60 Minutes.
Sweet.
Yeah, I'm really proud. They reached out to me the day after Anna was released, and I was like, I've been waiting for this call. You know, it's like, I was hoping this call would come. And, you know, if you watch the whole episode, they said that the Pope is going to be on first, and then it's you, and then it's something that Anderson Cooper did. And I'm like, this is really quite incredibly fortunate. So
that is outstanding.
It's, yeah. And they did a really, I haven't watched it, but I've read I've listened to the script for fact checking, and they've done a really good job of presenting the important part of the story it's really going to be good. So I do some independent consulting. I do contracting work now for the government, and which is it's been phenomenal, and I really enjoy it. You know, doors keep getting open for me as a result of this story, and it's important. You know, Anna would say, I'm in a group of people that are focusing on her, and she's like, those people shouldn't be focusing on me. They should be focusing on how we treat Cuba, how we treat Puerto Rico, you know, kind of the bigger picture stuff. When I started my new job as a contractor, the contracting company gave me the insider threat training. and there were seven people that were highlighted in this 30-minute training. She's one of them.
Mm.
22 years later, government employees who have clearances are still hearing the name Ana Montes and hearing the story because it's important. And she doesn't realize it. She doesn't really see that. But we are focusing on how to find the next Ana and don't be an Ana and you know, all that kind of stuff. So it is a very important story that I'm glad is getting out there. And I'm very proud to represent all the men and women, you know, Steve and everyone else that we worked with in the FBI, in NSA, in DIA, the agency that she worked for, and representing all of them and telling the story as much as we can.
Yeah, and it's at the end of your book, you give credit to a ton of people, which is very admirable because this is a team project. Are you also doing some teaching?
I am. I'm teaching a graduate course at Marymount University. I just finished up the first semester, and I did so well, they want me back.
Excellent.
And I love it. It's the first class teaching was like, oh my God, what am I doing? I'm supposed to be the smartest guy in the room, and you know, I wasn't. But it's so cool to be on the flip side of, you know, I talked about Ed Smith, my first professor who was retired at the time, to be the next generation's Ed Smith to me, to them, to hopefully inspire them to go work in law enforcement if that's where they want to. And if they want to go to the FBI, maybe someone's going to say, I want to work counterintelligence. And you don't have to tell me what it is, and I can spell it. And that's what I want to go work because I took Pete Lapp one time, and he inspired me to come work counterintelligence at the FBI or wherever. So that's kind of the hope and giving back a little bit to that next generation of folks that will hopefully come in and have that public service mindset that I was blessed to have.
Marymount's a very excellent school. Our oldest daughter got her master's degree there a couple years ago.
What was it in?
She's in HR.
Okay. Yeah.
She wants to be, she's Colombian by birth. We adopted her when she was a baby when we lived in South America. She's, you're not supposed to tell the lady's age. She's 30 years old. And but she's 4'11", and she wants to be the person that says, you're fired. No, not really. I'm kidding. Monica, if you heard that, I'm kidding, baby. But now you haven't told us how has your singing and guitar playing career advanced?
Boy.
You knew I was going to bring it up. I'm not going to let that roll.
Well, I mean, your listeners can't see that, but I have guitars on my wall. It actually advanced pretty well. I got to a point where I was playing. Where I live, we have a lot of breweries and wineries, and it was a nice. When I went through my divorce, I had a pretty steep child support payment that I finally have paid off my youngest kid finally, and she's all paid off. And playing music in wineries was a nice way to make some money on the side, and you know, no conflict of interest, no anything. You're sitting there with a guitar and a microphone and singing as people drink wine, and it became really fun, and it was a way to create a new identity outside of being an FBI agent.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't done it in, I had a little hand surgery and I couldn't play. And now I'm just with this full-time job I have, I'm pretty busy. I'm kind of enjoying having my weekends to myself and doing things that my significant other and I like doing, like yard work and, you know, going for a scooter. It's like, I don't need to play gigs anymore. And, you know, that rock star dream, I got to live it for a little while locally. I was county famous, and as my kids called me. And they're like, your dad, you're not like, because I'd run into people at the food store. Hey, Pete, when are you playing again? And my kids are like, here we go. Dad's like a celebrity. So they give me the slap. They're like, it's in the bio of the book. It's like,
it is.
Dad, you're not internationally famous like Taylor Swift or John Bon Jovi. You're only county famous. And I'm like, ooh. I like that. That's a song title.
Yeah, but you know, when they say something like that, you want to look at them and say, and what are you?
Yeah, well, no. Yeah.
I know. But I love the fact that we started out talking about you want to be a rock star, and we finish up, you are. County famous or not, brother. You made
Thank
it.
You
got to do what you wanted. God
you.
Bless you. Listen, everybody, if you want to find out more about Pete, he's on his website is LAPP, L-A-P-P Consulting. You can find him on LinkedIn at Peter J. Lapp. We just connected today. On Instagram and Facebook, he's on there as Pete Lapp, L-A-P-P. And on X, formerly Twitter, same thing, Pete Lapp. Did I leave any off?
Website is petelapp.com. So
there you go.
You can email me through there, contact me through there if you have any questions. But happy to take questions from anyone and have conversations. I really appreciate the time, Steve. It's been a great conversation. I love talking about the pre-case stuff because that's takes me back a little bit. I really appreciate that.
It does. And you know what we found when Morgan, I learned this from Morgan when he was still on here, is that our listeners seem to like to hear the personal side of the guests that we bring on. You know, anybody can bring on somebody that can talk about one thing or, you know, a very high level investigative case. But to get into the personal details, that's what makes Game of Crime a little bit different. So I'll ask you, Pete, to stand by. And for all our listeners, you stand by for the debrief. Can you believe what you just heard? This pompous little witch, Anna Montez, who thought she was smarter than everybody else, she thought her ideals were more important than the ideals and freedoms we have here in the United States, the freedoms that she enjoyed, who took an oath to protect and defend our Constitution and the people of the United States, but then betrayed that oath for a communist country that's run by a family of tyrants, of despots who only look out for themselves, who thought she knew what was going on with the people in government in Cuba, but in reality, she didn't know her ass from a hole in the ground, and may have directly caused the death of a U.S. military hero working in Central America. I can't believe this. Now, once she got arrested, she was sentenced to 25 years in prison. And you know what? 25 years is a long time. But where is she now? Well, you know, when she was released, she went to a U.S. territory to live with her mom, return to her family. You know, the mother of the family that she betrayed, she humiliated them and embarrassed them. That same family, in which most of them were or still are serving our country. She's living on the beautiful island of Puerto Rico. I mean, I just can't believe this. You know, this is one for that episode. You can't make this shit up. Listen, in my opinion, she betrayed, it's not my opinion, this is a fact. She betrayed our country for an oppressive communist regime that's, you know, it's known for its atrocities against its own people. She gets caught, she pleads guilty to her crime, she does her time in prison, and she still gets to live the free life of an American. I got to tell you, I'm having a hard time with getting over this one. You know, I understand why the U.S. government agreed to that length of time, but personally, and I think you might agree with me, I think she should spend the rest of her life in prison. She made the choice. We say it here all the time. I taught my children this. For every choice you make, there are consequences, good or bad. And she made the choice. You know, now, you know, I support the judicial system here in the United States. I know it's not perfect, but I've seen firsthand it's better than anything else that's out there. And we say that once a person has paid their debt to society, that they're free to rejoin us. Well, will I continue to publicly support our justice system? You bet your ass I will. But man, I got to be honest. There's times when I'd like to see someone like this piece of crap get much more than what she got. To see her get what she really, really deserved. Now, our guest, Pete and his colleagues, they did a fantastic job. That investigation, I've never worked one like that. I know very little about it. I learned as much as you did. But just like last week's episode with Heidi Chance and the crime, you know, she talked about human trafficking. These espionage cases, they're very difficult to make. They're very time-consuming. They're very financially strapping. I mean, think about it. One small slip-up on the part of the investigators and the target's gone in a heartbeat. They're in the wind. And we heard, you know, Anna had her go bag ready to go with maps and some cash. Pete told us a lot about some of the investigative tools and techniques they used to track these traitors down, and that was a real inside look. Make no mistake about it. Anna Montez is a freaking traitor. But once again, we heard about the dedication to duty, the commitment to excellence, and some of the sacrifices our brave law enforcement professionals take to bring another criminal to justice. Man, this was an excellent example of us being outsiders, but we're getting that inside look on how to catch a spy. So to Pete and all your colleagues, excellent job, man. Fantastic. Now, don't forget to check out Pete's book, Queen of Cuba, an FBI agent's insider account of the spy who evaded detection for 17 years. That's a mouthful. Just remember Queen of Cuba by Peter Lapp. you know, once I started reading that book, it's one of those that's hard to put down. It was that good. I'll have it listed on our Game of Crimes book list, along with a link where you can go to Pete's website, which is LAPP, LAPPconsulting.com. You can order it there, or you can go straight to Amazon and order it directly through them. You can also find Pete on Facebook, Instagram, and X at Pete LAPP, LAPP, and on LinkedIn at Peter J. LAPP. So check him out. Listen, I hope you enjoyed today's episode with Pete LAPP as much as I did. You know, I get fired up about certain topics, and I guess some of you probably say I get fired up about a lot of topics. But the thing is, I just don't understand why anyone, why would you betray your own country the way this piece of crap did? I mean, thank God we have heroes like Pete who work their butts off to protect the rest of us from people like Anna Montes. Okay, very quickly, don't forget to head over to Apple or Spotify. Click on those 5 stars. This simple action really helps us with the rating, and it keeps the Game of Crimes up and running. You can leave comments on Spotify as well, so do that. Also, head over to GameOfCrimesPodcast.com, where you'll find more information about the show, all our episodes, the book list, and more. Follow the show on social media, on Facebook and Instagram at Game of Crimes Podcast, and on X at Game of Crimes. Also on Facebook, join us at, also on Facebook, sorry about that, join us at the Game of Crimes fan page run by our favorite queen, Sandy Salvato. She's the lady that rules with the iron fist but wears the velvet glove. The fan page, I tell you what, is there's so many funny stories and anecdotes on there. And the thing is, you'll get to see how our members look out for one another. So come over and check us out. Do me a favor, a big favor, and tell your friends about Game of Crimes. Tell them to come on over and give us a listen. As I've said multiple times, you're probably tired of hearing this. The best advertising and marketing in the podcast world is word of mouth. And I really, really appreciate you guys helping me promote the show. As always, thanks for continuing to support Game of Crimes. You just don't know how much I appreciate your comments and ideas. Remember, we can have different ideas and different opinions, but that doesn't mean we can't continue to be friends. This woke society crap that's going on out there, I just don't get it. It's like if you disagree with me, we can't be friends anymore, and that's just not right. Finally, thanks for joining me to play the biggest, baddest, most dangerous game of all, the Game of Crimes. I'll see y'all next time.
Into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.